and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Ransom Stevens, and we're going to talk a little bit about his book, The God Patent, but we're going to talk a lot about what's in his head about particle physics and consciousness. How are you, Dr. Stevens?
Wonderful. How are you, Eva?
Good, thanks. Thanks for coming on my show tonight. I appreciate it.
Really my pleasure.
So before we get started, tell us a little bit about you, where we can find you, what you do, and kind of how you came to do what you do.
Well, as you said, my name's Ransom Stevens, and I was a particle physicist for about 15 years. I worked on experiments at Fermilab, at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and at CERN, also a really cool experiment at Cornell. And I was a physics professor at the University of Texas at Arlington. And now I did a stint in high tech for a while, helping engineers solve their physics problems. But now I am a speaker and novelist. And the way I came to do that, I don't really know. I've always been a writer, and so this was something I always really wanted to do. And so my book, The God Patent, I'll tell you a little bit of background about that. What happened is that in 1993, I was working at the University of Florida, living there, and late at night, I was walking around in a swamp, and I'd been immersed in physics for 13 years coming up on that, and I had this idea of what the soul might be, a model for the soul. And the thing that I found interesting about it is that it's not very religious, and while it does require a nugget of faith, the amount of faith can be boiled down to a single question, a single yes or no question. That if you say yes to this question, then you believe this model of the soul. If you say no, then you don't. And I really like that. I think great leaps of faith tend to take us into the weeds.
Well, we are binary beings, so that makes a lot of sense that it has to be a yes or no question. So what's the question?
Well, it's in the book, and I can't really tell you. It doesn't really make any sense without all of the background. So my book is a novel, and the reason I put this model of the soul into a novel is that I think that the great strength of literature is by putting people into the characters' heads so that they actually go through the process of coming to understand these things themselves, sort of vicariously. And so in my book, the character who figures out what the soul is an adolescent skate rat. She's a skater. Her name is Katerina, and she's a math prodigy, and she figures out what the soul is.
That was a very exciting thing for the book, by the way, for it to be that. Especially for us parents that have teenagers, it gives us hope.
Well, thank you.
Okay, and where can people find you and find your book?
TheGodPatent.com is a good place.
Spell it, please.
The, T-H-E, God, G-O-D, Patent, P-A-T-E-N-T.com.
Okay. And they can order there, and they can send a question if they have a question about something you say on the show, right?
Yeah. My email address should be pretty easy to find there.
Okay. So we're going to talk about consciousness tonight, obviously. And the first thing I want to start out with is, what is your definition of that thing so we can make sure we're all on the same page when we're listening to you?
I go back to Descartes. I think that anything that is aware of its own existence has consciousness. That's sort of a real baseline definition, simple awareness.
Okay.
Not necessarily being awake, though. I think that, you know, you're sort of pre-reflectively aware that you exist when you're asleep, however deep in dreams you are. And I wouldn't limit it to human beings necessarily either, or even necessarily, mammals with large brains. But it seems to me lots of things are aware of their own existence.
What do you call that force that underlies entanglement or physical reality? What do you call that?
Physical reality?
That underlies it.
Well, I'd call it the space-time metric, I guess, if I was forced to.
But the reason I'm asking this question is because that's a linguistics is a problem when people talk about consciousness. Some people think it's the ground of all being. Some people think it's the irreducible unit. Some people think it's awareness. Some people think it's the opposite of being in a coma. So I just want to see where we're, you know, where your interpretation lies with that. In other words, the irreducible unit would be equivalent to the non-dual state or God to some people, and that's the way I look at it. So I want to be on the same page with you.
Well, I think ultimately, let me just give you a nugget about the way I think. And first of all, there's a big difference to just bouncing around ideas and what, when pinned down, I personally actually believe. And so I like to think about a lot of ideas. It doesn't mean that I believe them. Ultimately, you know, with consciousness, I think consciousness boils down to, if forced to underlie it, is biochemistry, that mm-hmm. it's a biochemical process.
You mean awareness or consciousness itself?
Yeah.
So does consciousness equate to awareness to you?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That's how I would define consciousness. Something has consciousness if it is aware of its own existence.
Okay. All right. Your book talks about you're trying to create, from what I understand, some kind of energy machine that has a soul to it. Where did that, is that right? Am I understanding that correctly?
It's close. Yeah, this is the premise of the book and why it's titled The God Patent. And that is that these two characters, Ryan McNear, the main character, and his buddy Foster Reed, back in the 90s, you know, when technology was really booming, they both worked for this company. Now, one of the things that you get in your packet when you start working for a technology company is a memo that almost always says that you get a bonus for submitting patents, usually about $500. And that if the patent is approved, then you get another bonus, usually $2,000 or even $5,000. So it's kind of a game that engineers play in high-tech companies of throwing out patents just to get the bonus. You know, anything that they dress it up in enough jargon, they can actually get it past the company's patent attorneys and into the patent office. Of course, very rarely do they get approved, but sometimes they do. In fact, a friend of mine holds the patent for drilling a hole in fiberglass because he dressed it up in enough jargon. So what these two characters did is one of them, Ryan, he patented the soul. And he patented the soul by writing a submission, a patent submission, that describes a software algorithm that is self-generating. So basically, he describes a software algorithm that has free will and is aware of itself. So that was his patent, at least in his mind, that was a patent for the soul. And his buddy Foster patents creation. And dresses up his somewhat mostly Christian but heavily physicsized version of creation, and calls it a power generator. The idea being, at least in his mind, that the creation of the universe is moving energy, and that his idea was that the creation of the universe was a conversion of spiritual energy into physical energy. And in the book, there's actually his argument spelled out in some detail, and it's kind of a fun idea.
So do you believe this to be true?
No.
Okay, so it's just all fiction.
Well, it's a cool idea, and like I said, you know, just because if I'm nailed down, do you believe this is true, it doesn't mean I'm not a fan of it. I've always been a big fan of reincarnation. I just don't believe it.
Okay. I don't think I believe in reincarnation either per se, as most people use that word. But I do think that we exist in multiple dimensions, or maybe parallel universes.
Yeah, the tree.
Simultaneously all at one time, and that,
yeah,
like a record album.
Right.
And you can, depending on where the needle is, it's depending on what song's playing at the time, and if you're not there where the needle is playing, then you can't hear it. That's kind of the way I think about it.
I picture a tree. If you picture a branch on a tree that's got other branches, and if you lay down a branch like that so that everything is pointing in one direction, all the branches and sub-branches and sub-sub-branches, then if you line that up and you say that time is pointed along this axis, then every one of those branch points where two sticks come together, those are events in your life that you might argue are junctions into different possible futures. So when you say that you believe in parallel universes and that sort of thing, that's the image that comes to my mind.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe that?
No.
So do you think that we just exist right now and that's it?
Yep. I think there's something very interesting in that, though. Yeah. And that is that think about how you move about in space, right? You have a lot of freedom about where you move. I can move north, south, east, west, all over the surface of this planet. The planet's moving. So we have a lot of freedom about moving around in space. But in time, we have none. We are in the present. We can look back. We can plan.
Yeah, we're in the moment right now.
Yeah, exactly. And that's all we get. So whereas geometrically, physically, in space-time, they're intimately linked, okay? But our perception is completely different between space and time. We're stuck in an instant, always in this instant that's flowing forward. Mm-hmm. But in space, we can move around. So it kind of begs the question, what if, right? What if you could move in time the same way that you can move in space?
Okay. I have to tell you something. This interview is probably going to go different than I anticipated because of some of your questions.
They always
It'll be
do,
very,
don't they?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not normally, I have to tell you, not in this way. Because normally I'm expecting, have an idea because it's not a fiction book, and I kind of thought that by your fiction book that you might think the same way. So this will be very interesting for me and my listeners. So it's your perspective that we exist only in this moment. There's no continuation of existence if the body drops away.
Well, again, if you press me to say what I believe, but, the model of the soul that's described in my book provides a mechanism of consciousness that would continue after your body's gone.
But you don't believe that.
I am a huge fan of this, and, I call myself an open-minded atheist, and what that means is that, I came up with this idea. I really like it, and it's hard for me to say absolutely no, I don't believe it, because I think the idea has a lot of merit and is really that there's really something to it. But in terms of taking that step of faith required to believe it, I don't know. You'd have to.
Okay,
I'm not sure.
All right. So let me ask you this. What do you believe to be the source of creativity?
I think that the source of creativity in a human being is ultimately driven by environment and genetics. It's ultimately a biochemical process, and that by evolution, our species has developed different skill sets and talents. And then when we're born, of course, we find things that we're attracted to, things that we're good at. I think that the very first time you do something has a huge impact on whether or not you believe that you'll be good at it, and that just might be the birth point of talent.
Okay. So where did, Mozart or Beethoven's creativity come from as being a child prodigy?
Yeah, no, this is a great
question.
Where
did that come from? Since they had no conditioning to do it.
Right, especially
the
child,
didn't do it. So where did it come from?
Yeah, the child prodigy is an excellent example. And frequently in those cases you have an element of autism, right? You have an element of neural process that is very unique in that individual.
Mm-hmm. So, still, where did it come from? The autism?
Oh, I think that it that talent, that innate skill, that, and usually, you know, these things, especially in children, where they're really clearly defined talents, intellectual talents, that they always seem to be very close to mathematical things.
And so it comes from where?
It comes from the random process of genetics and the hormones that are in the womb. There's a lot of things, and now I'm getting pretty well out of my area of expertise.
Oh, that's okay. So my next question is, what do you believe to be the source of intentionality?
The source of intentionality?
Or the source of intention.
Okay.
Wait a minute. What is the source of an intention?
The source of, I think, ultimately, the source of intention goes to appetite and what and desire. So intent, when there's a goal, that is derived from a complex set of desires and appetites. And let me explain this a little bit farther, and this actually goes into something I'm working really hard on for my next book. But if we think of a human being moving through their life, they have five senses that are well-defined, right? Hearing, vision, scent, taste, and touch. And so that's the complete, if we just limit ourselves to those things that are obvious, then that is the complete interface with the universe from in your head. That's the entire data set you get. Everything else, interpretation, is then developed by complex combinations of interpretations of those five inputs. So intent comes from, ultimately, appetites. Appetites are fundamentally our closest, most fundamental reaction to stimulus through the five senses: hunger, the desire to taste and smell, and mating, touch, physical pleasure. And so I think that intent probably boils down to the processing of the five senses.
So could consciousness be active without the presence of those senses?
Now, see, this is a fun question, okay, because now I got something I think you'll really like. So consider the scientific method. All right. Now, the scientific method basically boils down to, we acquire data, we develop hypotheses, more than one, hopefully, for how these data came to be. And then we design, of those hypotheses, we pick the one that is simplest. We apply Occam's razor. We take that hypothesis that relies on the fewest assumptions, the simplest assumptions, and say, well, all right, this is our best candidate. Then we do an experiment based on what that hypothesis predicts. Okay, so we have a hypothesis that explains a set of data. That hypothesis then predicts something else. So we do an experiment to test, to see if that prediction is accurate. Okay, and so then we get another data set, and we kind of go through this loop. And if the data set's inconsistent with that hypothesis, then we go to the next one, and so forth. But there's something that we've left out, and this is what I call the zero step of the scientific method. There is, ironically, and one of the most delicious ironies in the scientific method is that there is faith, right? Because before you accept data, you have to accept that the input of these five senses is accurate. That's the assumption. That's the first step of faith in anything we do. Well, not anything, but certainly in science, is to accept that there really is a world out there and that we have a reasonably objective, well, it's possible to have a reasonably objective way of looking at it. So you see, there's this kind of, science is very empirical, relies very much on data, does its very best to eliminate opinion and to just be dry and figure out what things really are. But the very first thing it has to do is take a metaphysical jump off a diving board and admit that, yes, okay, I'm going to assume that there is a world out there.
Okay, this person's probably going to be confusing because I'm limited in language, and linguistics is always an issue, you know. We would both agree that atoms and molecules are made up of particles, right?
Certainly seems to be the case. Yes, okay. That is the odds-on bet.
And I would imagine that we would both tend to agree that the further down that you go in a particle, the more particles that you would find.
Well, that's not completely true. What happened is, historically, is that as we went to smaller and smaller length scales, right, we've had the atom. Okay, great. We got this periodic table, tells us no end of information, predictable information about their chemical structure and how they behave chemically. But then at higher energies, we discover that they break up into smaller pieces. And then we discover that those pieces break up into way, way many pieces, okay? Mm-hmm. This is about 1950. And then there was the quark model. And the quark model was, it's kind of interesting because it was really a model. When it was thrown together, Murray Gell-Mann really didn't believe that they existed. It was just a model, and it predicted the basic structure of all these particles that they were finding at cyclotrons. And then later, it started to look like the quark model had more to it than he thought. And it was developed from a model into a theory. So now we're in a state where the total number of particles that we believe exists is 3 times 3, 6, 9, 12, plus the photon. So there's a handful, like 24 or something.
Okay.
So it's not, as we go smaller, we don't get more and more fundamental particles. We pretty much are at a point where we have a set.
Okay, I get you now.
Okay.
So when we, I didn't know that, so that's an interesting thing to learn. But when we get down to what we call the irreducible unit of a particle, what do you find?
Let's take an electron, because it's a good example particle, because it is probably the best, it's definitely the best studied of all the particles that we've found. And it is also point-like, as point-like as we can tell at the very highest energies. Okay, so what happens here is that we have this particle, this electron, and if we think of everything around it as vacuum, right, there's nothing else there, nothing real there anyway. The geometry of space and time.
I have a question.
Go for it.
So what's in the vacuum? Is it void? Is there energy?
Right. This is the fun part, yeah.
Okay.
So the vacuum is not nothing. It's a vacuum. And what we've learned from relativistic quantum field theory, stuff that people like Richard Feynman did, is that the vacuum is actually a very dynamic place and that there are all these virtual processes going on. So as we try to get closer, so say you've got, just picture an electron as a dot on somewhere in the universe, and there's nothing else real there. But as we try and get closer and closer to it to see what structure it might have, what we find is that its properties change as we get closer. The actual charge on the electron gets higher as we get closer to it. And the reason is that the vacuum is shielding it by popping up virtual particles that shield the charge. And the way how that happens is from Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
You mean when you observe it?
Well, no. It's the other side of Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay. So,
you mean when there's one thing, there's going to be the opposite thing there too?
No, there's two basic ways of interpreting the uncertainty principle. There's the one that you mentioned, which is fundamentally a limit on how accurately you can measure something, and that when you make a choice to measure something, it changes your ability to measure something else, the conjugate quantity, with any accuracy. All right, so the best example of that is energy and time. That if I measure the energy of a state very, very accurately, then I lose all information about the duration of time of when that state exists. Similarly, if I measure exactly when something happens, I lose information about the energy.
Okay, because you can only focus on one thing at a time?
No, it's more fundamental than that. What happens is that the product...
How can you retain the information on that level if you're doing it in quantum units like that?
What you do is you're changing. When you measure the energy, you're changing the properties of the time-like properties.
Oh, okay, I got you.
Okay, so this is what I describe as, in fact, the character Amy Nutter in my novel describes as the watermelon theory, because measuring things at the quantum level is kind of like picking up a watermelon seed. If you pick up the watermelon seed and get a good grip on it, it squirts right away, you know? All try to do that. You pick up the watermelon seed, you get a handle on it, and then it squirts away. But you can pick them up. You dig into the flesh and pull it out with some of the watermelon flesh, and then you have the seed in your hand. But as you try and get closer and closer to it, it'll squirt away. And making measurements at the quantum level is frequently like that. You sacrifice information in favor of other information. And like you were saying, it boils down to ultimately people being part of the universe. We can't truly objectively measure things. We have to make choices.
Okay. My next question is, and I have several more. We've got 30 minutes. So the next one is, if when you get down there to the point of the vacuum, what is it? Where's the mass? In other words, what forms physical reality? Are we living in a hologram?
Well, it appears all evidence points to us living in a three dimensions of space and one dimension of time, and that geometry is dictated by gravitational forces, predominantly. All the forces, but gravity plays the biggest role.
So if that's true, there are no serotonin and norepinephrine and dopamine floating around in space.
Not as far as I know.
So what is that? Where's the... I mean, there's got to be a soul somewhere. The soul's got to be pre-existing in all time, and the body just happens to be there and then goes away at some point with no change. Doesn't it?
I don't think it does.
I mean, something's
cool
there already. What is that all there already?
The vacuum, space.
Yeah, but
it has to have
an intention to manipulate those electrons and those positrons and protons. I mean, something's got to push those things together to form some sort of mass. What is it?
Well, mass is a different question. We'll leave that out for the minute.
Well, I don't think mass exists. I don't. So you can address that because.
Seems to. Well, something very much like mass exists.
Yeah,
if you get hit by a ping pong ball, it feels very different than if you get hit by a locomotive.
But I think, if you go down to the quantum level, where is it?
Well, mass.
Do you know where I'm going?
I don't know, but we can talk a little about something that's pretty cool in this realm, if you want, and that is particles that have mass and the particles that don't have mass. Okay, there's something that almost is pretty much a defining quality. Something that does not have mass goes the speed of light in vacuum. There's this magic number, the speed of light in vacuum. Mm-hmm. It's about 3 billion meters per second. And something
now, is it
mass.
A particle?
Sure.
And does it break down into smaller particles?
No.
If you had a microscope to look at it, would you see smaller particles?
No.
You would just see one blob of hard substance. That's all you would find.
Well,
and there would be no separation.
Hard.
There would be no space in it.
It could be a wave, but yeah. If we're going to boil it down to one drop, to one photon, for example, a piece of light, that's something that doesn't have mass, and that's why we call this magic constant, this thing that dictates so much of the geometry of space and time, the speed of light in vacuum, the speed of light. Okay. Mm-hmm. So a single photon is a tiny, tiny particle and can't be broken up into other pieces. And it is going the speed of light. And what that means is that time is not passing for massless particles. They're zooming through, and time doesn't pass at that speed. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, something that has mass, the defining quality for it is that it can't go the speed of light. It can get closer and closer and closer, but it would take an infinite amount of energy to get it all the way up there to the speed of light. This is special relativity.
Okay.
The essence of it. And in particle physics, it means that particles that are massless go the speed of light. Particles that are massive don't. They go less than the speed of light in whatever reference frame you might be in.
Okay. I don't mean to be difficult here, but I just want to understand this.
Yeah.
If it's a particle of mass, that means that is the irreducible unit of that particle.
Well,
you can't break it down to any lower form or any smaller form so that there's space in between.
Yeah, right. So that,
it is the lowest form.
It's truly point-like, yes, that it does not have spatial extent.
And where did that come from?
Particles come from energy, interactions of energy. So if you have a massless particle, if you have, for example, two photons, two of these massless things, they can collide in such a way that they will create matter. In fact, I did my PhD thesis on an experiment that did exactly this, collided two photons, and then we analyzed the stuff that came out. So the simplest thing is that two photons can collide and form an electron and its antimatter equivalent, a positron.
But so if you have those two photons that collide,
yeah,
that makes a piece of matter, you could not break them back down to two photons.
Well, they could, and they probably would rapidly annihilate. The electron and positron would probably find each other pretty quick. And when they annihilated, the largest probability is that they would convert back into two photons.
So that would actually be the irreducible unit then. So really there would be no mass except for temporarily, right?
Well, the energy doesn't change.
Right. The energy doesn't stop, it just changes form.
And the electrons both have mass, but the two photons don't. So it's energy that is the thing that's being conserved, the thing that is constant through the whole process, through every process as far as we know.
Okay.
So the energy is fixed. But then whether that energy moves from motion, energy of motion, or energy of mass, or a coiled spring, there's lots of different ways that energy can show up. So
okay.
I would think that the energy is actually, if we want to say that something is irreducible, I would say that given a system, that there are a few quantities that are fixed in that system, and energy is certainly one of them. There's also others, though. There are momentum. And momentum is that thing that basically tells you how much something is moving. It's a combination of how much something weighs and how fast it's going.
Right, I understand that. Okay.
So momentum and energy, and then there's other types of momentum. There's angular momentum. So there's a bunch of these things that are actually conserved quantities, and that means that in a given system they're fixed. The amount of that stuff is fixed. So that's irreducible for that system. But it doesn't mean you couldn't poke a hole in that system and then give it something, right? You can always cheat. And that's kind of what we do in experiments.
Okay. All right. I could ask 30 or 40 more questions on this, but I won't do that because I'm moving to something else. Because I don't want to bore you with my questions.
Well, at some point we need a whiteboard to really show all this stuff, don't we? And we don't have that at our leisure.
So my next question is, what is mind to you?
Mind?
Uh-huh.
Brain?
And then my next one, Excuse me? I was going to say my next one is going to be about free will. We've got 20 minutes, so save some room to talk about free will.
Okay, so I think mind is very simple. I wouldn't distinguish the operation of the brain from the mind, and I usually would just say that something's a result of the brain processing stuff, and that's what we call the mind. But I don't think that. See, ultimately, I don't think that there's a reason to take that step that there needs to be something other than the physical. See what I mean? I don't think that there's a compelling reason.
Have you ever had a mystical experience?
I've had no end of interesting experiences. And
have you ever had a mystical experience that you couldn't explain?
Well, I think we have experiences we can't explain pretty much all the time.
I guess one reason I'm curious is because I had a mystical experience, and it happened when I was 40 years old. And it was kind of like a near-death experience, but it happened in my sleep, so I didn't have to die. And when I woke up the next morning, I was profoundly psychic, and I'd never been psychic in my life, to my knowledge. Now I can see that perhaps it existed to some extent, and I didn't understand it. But now I can do it at will, and I can detect disease now about 10 years into the future, and I can even give you subtle symptoms that you have right now that's indicative of that disease. And inevitably, if I tell somebody they have something coming and they don't believe me, within a couple of years they call me back and say, why didn't you listen? So where did that come from?
Wow, Eva.
I mean, it's not a brain phenomenon, I can tell you that. Where did it come from and what is it?
Oh, I have no idea. I'll tell you what I suspect. I suspect, and this is not what I believe, but this is what the scientific method would compel us to conclude in the absence of hard data, and that is that you are that you have a skill of assembling data from your five senses in a way very rapidly that gives you this information. In other words, that you've developed
intuition. I don't even
intuition.
Have to be in the presence of the person doing it. I can be on the phone.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what the scientific method would argue. I don't have anything better than that.
You must have some gut feeling. You write about this stuff. You had this. It came from somewhere. I think you know more than you know that you know.
Well, I do. Like I said, I sure do love entertaining these different ideas, and so that is the idea that the scientific method would reduce to. Okay.
If we can
measure this phenomenon in a reproducible, objective way, then that would open up a huge catalog for study.
Well, what about Bob John's work at Princeton?
I'm not familiar with him. I read some of, I think you sent me a transcript of an interview you did with him.
Yeah, well, with Brenda Dunn, his...
Yeah, that's right.
Cohort.
Right, and I live down the street from the Institute of Noetic Science with Marilyn Schlitz, who is someone I really respect.
Yeah, she's fabulous.
She
and
really
their
is.
Work
yeah.
is fabulous there. So I just, it strikes me odd that your perspective is that this is all there is, yet you
but
have...
Wait, stop.
Okay.
But when I say this is all there is, I'm not saying that in any way negative. I'm saying this, there's a lot here. It's really quite amazing. I don't know that we need more.
I totally agree.
What we have is pretty intense.
But I think there's more, and I think there's a lot of evidence that there's more.
That's the thing, though, is the evidence that if we apply the scientific method, then the evidence, we have to go to the simplest assumption. And introducing some non-physical thing is a pretty big assumption. So that's an assumption you don't want to make until you absolutely have to. And then it becomes physical anyway, because when you detect that someone has an illness, which, by the way, I do not envy you in the least.
It's a gift and a plague.
Yeah.
But I can turn it on and off. It doesn't inundate me. I turn it on and off.
I had such a feeling I've had such feelings a couple of times where I would look at somebody and think to myself, oh, wow, that person has breast cancer. That person, something is going to happen to that person. And I followed up on a few of them, and I'm very happy to say that I was wrong every time.
Well, I'm not. I really am not.
Yeah. I think that...
I know in the first 5 minutes, I'll ask you a couple of questions, and if I say I can't read you, then I can't. But if I tell you that I can, I'm right.
Sure, glad I can't do that.
Well, I kind of think I'm not special, that everybody has an ability, but they may come in different forms. They may see, or they may hear, or they may feel. I personally hear it auditorily. Now, how do you get your information about this book? Did you hear it auditorily, like you get an idea and, oh, yeah, yeah?
Well, no, that's a fun question, because I was actually, I was walking around. I couldn't sleep. My wife was asleep. My daughter was asleep. The dog and I were up. And we were living in Gainesville, Florida, not too far from the university. And it was a steamy Florida night. And so it was dark. There was no moon. And I thought to myself, after drinking a few Busch Draft Light beers, that it'd be fun to go walk around the swamp in the middle of the night when you can't see anything, because I knew it'd be really loud. And as I was walking there, and I couldn't see, but boy, it was loud. The dog kept growling. And at this point, I was a postdoctoral research associate. So I'd done my PhD 2 years before. So I was at that point in the career of a physicist where you're really on top of your game. You know, I was about 28 years old, so really, really sharp at that time. And the pieces kind of fell together because I was thinking about life and death and the great questions. And this model of the soul came together, and it's based on, I like to say, inspired by several disparate physical phenomena, things that are well understood in the lab. But it does require a step of faith, and rather than a great leap, though, which is what I really liked about it. So in the process, I think that I had been mulling over these ideas for a very long time, and that they, at that moment when I was, you know, free to think, wasn't being interrupted or bothered other than by just the sheer joyous fascination of being in the middle of a swamp in Florida in the middle of the night, which is kind of a stupid thing to do, by the way.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
And it all kind of fell into place. And I literally sat down in the sand and just concentrated on it, and then was pretty psyched.
Did it all drop in at one time?
No.
Or did you have
to think
so about it?
When I was in the swamp that night, it all came together. But I had, you know, ideas of various models of things like reincarnation, different types of reincarnation, certainly nothing like the Hindu approach, but things that were more smeared and had, if you want, certain flavors from statistical physics and quantum physics. Although this model of the soul is inspired by those, it doesn't actually require any of them.
I want to ask you about what you think about Ian Stevenson's work, but I won't, because I want to ask you about free will. Do you think, and if we have time, we can ask about Ian Stevenson's work. Do you think that we have complete free will? Now, be careful here, because it's a trick question.
Well,
I don't mean for it to be a trick, but it is. Complete free will, to me, is different than free will.
All right. Can you define free will, then? So I can answer.
Okay. I think, let me just give you a scenario. I tell a little story that we're 2 years old, and we're sitting in the back seat of a car, and we're strapped into a car seat with a little yellow steering wheel. And I do this to almost every physicist or scientist that comes on my show, because you'd be surprised at the answers I get. We're strapped in a little yellow car seat with a little yellow steering wheel, and the car is driving forward, and we come to a stop sign. Whose steering wheel? The playground's on the right and the grocery store is on the left. Obviously, the 2-year-old wants to go to the playground. And obviously Source or God or your mother, father, whatever you want to call that higher power that's sitting in the front seat, whoever that is,
yeah,
driving the car, whose steering wheel is going to work?
So free, absolute free will would be that my steering wheel would always be the one that works. Right.
Right.
Okay. Then I would say no, clearly, because I think my mother's going to take me wherever she wants to, and if the playground is in the works, then it was probably in the works. She'd probably decided that long before I got the we'll see, which always seemed to be the answer when you ask for those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom was pretty good about that. We'll see almost always meant yes. So in that, with that definition, I would say no, that we don't have free will. But let me back up a little bit about free will, and because it's really a question about whether something is deterministic or not, right?
So how do you define it so we can be on the same page?
Okay. So, right, that's what I want to back up. So a Newtonian universe, right, the laws of nature that Isaac Newton came up with are deterministic. If I know the direction of every piece of matter in the universe and their speed and their masses, then I can predict everything that will ever happen in that universe in Newtonian physics. So in that universe, it's deterministic. Nothing has any free will. All right. Now, that doesn't actually turn out to be true, but it doesn't require quantum physics either. Quantum physics is one way out of that, where things go from being deterministic to being probabilistic, right? So that instead of saying for certain that event A is going to happen, I can then say event A is likely to happen with some probability. And if I know everything, I could calculate that probability. But even by knowing everything, I can't say for certain that something's going to happen. And that could be for a lot of reasons. One, the obvious one, is that if you know everything, well, as soon as you know it, you change it, so then you don't know it anymore. But anyway, so deterministic or indeterministic, it turns out that the vast majority of systems, anything that's got really more than three or four pieces to it, that the tiniest difference in the initial state leads to completely different final states. Right? A tiny, tiny difference.
But back to what I said about free will, I mean, even though I use that scenario, then I have to go over and look at Bob John's work where they moved those ping pong balls with just intention. So it makes me believe that if we are able to get in an altered state like high delta or low theta, our field, whatever that is very cohesive, then we can manipulate reality to some small extent. What would your comment be on that? And we've got
I think we manipulate reality extensively. We're on the phone. That's quite a manipulation right there.
How do you know that wasn't the mama driving the car?
I don't. But I would if I was going to think like a scientist about it, then I would force myself to use Occam's razor and make that choice of hypotheses that rests on the simplest assumptions. Okay?
But do you really think scientists are always right in conventional science today?
Of course not. Absolutely not. No. And this is why it's so easy to pick on them, is because they're not right, right? I want to go back to free will for a second first, because where I was driving is that, yes, we have free will, but it's not deterministic. We have the power to affect our lives, and we can make choices. But we probably don't have as much free will as it feels like. And
yeah,
for example, does a dog have free will? Now, a dog, as far as we know, doesn't really, it doesn't think reflectively. Everything that they think about is right before them in the instant, and certain sense will dig up experiences that they draw from, but partly because they don't have language, they just don't elucidate, coherent thoughts that they could write down if they had a thumb. But do they have free will? I think they do. I train dogs, and I've pretty damn certain that they can make a choice to do it I want them to or what they want to, right? But as we go down in cranial capacity, ultimately, I suspect that we reach a point where an organism no longer has free will and is simply responding to the dictates of their appetite. Okay?
Yeah.
So it's a continuum, and we have a lot of free will, but probably less than we think.
I also like to say that, in my perspective, that we have complete free will in the way we react to a stimulus. You know, if we don't get to turn right and go into, I mean, it's a complicated topic, you know, and language again is a problem.
Yeah, we should do it all mathematically.
Yeah, if I knew how to do the numbers. I still know how to do the numbers. I mean, when I had this thing happen to me is when I got this, I got a lot of understanding. Before that, I had no idea even what to think about it. It just came one day. But, you know, we're sitting at the stop sign and we don't get to turn right and go to the playground. We go left and go to the grocery store. But I think here's where our free will comes in. We have free will to either throw a fit or say, okay.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I'm on board with that.
Okay.
We do have free will for that, though probably not as much as we think. If
I think that's where the chemical stuff comes in.
It is. Exactly. That's exactly right. If it's 8 p.m., and I had a really nice meal half an hour ago, and you set a nice India Pale Ale in front of me, I'm going to drink it. And whether I have free will or not, my free will is going to say, oh, boy, look at that. I'm going to drink that.
Yeah.
So it's a response to an appetite. And one of the hardest things that we do in life is learn the ways to respond to our appetites that are most effective for meeting our personal goals. And let me give you an example of that that's kind of fun.
We got 2 minutes.
Okay.
And he'll cut us off, but and so if you want time to be able to reach
out. No, if you have one more question, we should do that.
No, I don't. I'm just saying if you want to be able to say where people can find you again.
Oh, okay.
Leave yourself time to do it.
I have several web pages. The easiest one is thegodpatent.com. And again, it's a novel and it's fun. You might check the Amazon reviews to see if you'd like it. There's a whole bunch of them, and most people really do seem to like it, a lot of more people than I expected to. It is a novel and a story of this guy trying to fix his life after making a lot of mistakes, and his chief ally is this death-obsessed teenage girl who happens to be a math prodigy and figures out what the soul is.
I found that very entertaining reading.
Oh, good. I'm really
but
glad.
But I thought it was your life when I first found it, and I was like, oh, man, I'm going to pick this man about enlightenment.
No, it's not me, no. It's actually a nightmare that never happened. I never made those bad choices, but
thank
I always
God.
Worried that I might.
Thank
so
God.
It was kind of a nightmare, and the version Katerina is not based on my daughter. It's kind of the nightmare version of what I thought my daughter was going to be like when she was born, but of course, children surprise us.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. So we can find you at thegodpatent.com, right?
Yeah.
All right, we got a minute left. Can you tell us that funny thing or not? Do we have time for that?
I forget what it was, the funny thing.
Okay. Well, you'll have to come back sometime and tell us again.
I'd love to.
When you finish your new book.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on. I enjoyed having you.
Thank you very much, Eva. I love your accent, and you are a wonderful person to share an hour with.
Thank you. I'm honored. Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. Integral Health. Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.